Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
From ARK Invest, this is FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. I'm Brett Winton. With me, I have Nemo Despot. He is our multiomics analyst extraordinaire. Nemo, today we are going to talk about AI-driven drug discovery. We're speaking to the CEO and CFO of Generate Bio. We're an investor in Generate Bio. Generate Bio is using, well, what are they doing, Nemo?
So they are basically reimagining protein therapeutics drug discovery. So as the name says, you know, they are engineering protein drugs. So when you think about protein drugs overall, so one thing that comes to mind is the antibodies, but also recombinant insulin is the type of the protein drug. And so biologics and the protein drugs had been very successful, but, you know, the discovery of them was very stochastic and very, very expensive. So Generate was founded in 2018 by Flagship Pioneering, actually to try to solve this problem with the data and engineering kind of first approach. And so what they actually are doing, they have the lab in the loop, or how we call it, self-driving lab kind of concept, where they use already existing protein data that exists in the protein data bank and in other data banks, create a model which then gives them the sequences of the protein drug of interest. Then they test that functionally, but also with structural biology tools such as the cryo-EM, and then they kind of iterate on that kind of loop to develop protein drug much faster. So it's actually kind of combining AI with structural biology and functional testing to design protein drugs faster, cheaper, and to make them better.
So we have an overarching thesis that AI in drug discovery will reduce the cost of getting a drug to market, basically from $2.3 billion on average to get a drug to market, and it takes 13 years, down to, at least at an initial set of assets coming to market, down to about 8 years and less than $1 billion to get a drug to market. In the interview, they actually validated at least the 8 years data point, which I thought was interesting since we hadn't coordinated with him on that work, but it seems to be what they're possibly going to do with their first asset here. What's interesting about that to me is it means that you can get better return on capital. So we think the industry as a whole has been a terrible steward of investor capital. They've invested in R&D that's returned 4%. So like, I'd rather, you know, hold, you know, money in a bank account, not take equity risk to get 4%. And because drugs are so expensive to develop and they take so long, here, you can potentially get a drug to market sooner. It can be more cleanly pocketed into the biological construct you're trying to get into. So it causes less side effects and it's more efficacious. Can either go after pockets from Generate Bio's perspective that previously we couldn't get to. And so, you know, potentially solve diseases that, you know, good luck with traditional methods. And so it could change the return, you know, characteristics of, you know, these drug development platforms generally. How do you think about Generate's approach versus Absci, Recursion, you know, the other kind of AI drug discovery companies that we're invested in?
So what is really unique about Generate approach and why, you know, it really caught my eye is that they are really taking structural biology first approach. So it's Absci is what they are doing, you know, is actually kind of high throughput assay, which they are kind of measuring the binding. So they're measuring the kind of functional end of the solution that they need. And generate is actually, in addition to kind of actually measuring the effects of the protein kind of therapeutic, they are actually also doing the structural biology, which actually helps them make better model. And so EPSI is making the model based on the kind of functional kind of output, which they kind of see as the main one, where the generate is kind of taking the structural kind of first approach.
It's kind of like one level upstream, as in like with EPSI, it's like...
It's even more, I would say, complementary. You know, then kind of, I don't want to look at them as the one against each other, because there's definitely, you know, we know that AI models can also learn without the structure, based on the affinities of the bindings and other kind of functional kind of components. And so this is, to me, more like a kind of complementary approach versus a kind of competitive kind of approach. But given how this space is huge, given that we have seen how biologics and drugs are really potent and efficacious, you know, this is not zero-sum game. There's going to be many players, right? And so this is why I think, you know, and what is difficult with structure-first approaches, these structural methods are usually really expensive, take so much time. They are not high-throughput kind of fashion, right? And AI needs a lot of data. And so that's why kind of EPSI went with this kind of other route versus, you know, structure kind of first. But what Generate did is actually they took cryo-EM and then they kind of really focused on making it, you know, to a certain degree high throughput. And they keep kind of pushing the limits there.
Yeah, so it's cryo-EM is using basically a microscope to directly see the protein structure. And so you can imagine AlphaFold is a famous example of I take a DNA recipe and I can predict the shape of the protein that comes off it. So Generate is building on top of AlphaFold's work in some ways, where it's saying, well, actually, if you measure it directly, you can get more precision than AlphaFold is generating. And you can, you know, discover protein structures where AlphaFold actually performs poorly. And so the net is their ambition is to produce more kind of structural biological information than exists in the public domain that AlphaFold was trained on. And so in effect, they could have a proprietary AlphaFold that is experimentally validated and net better, and then use that to run their drug discovery and generation engine.
And this is the key point there, right? They're feeding all the data in their model. So over the time, their model will be faster, cheaper, and better. And this rate of change of improvement, I think, is the key metrics when we look in the AI drug discovery companies, right? We all agree AI should be enabling things to be faster, cheaper, and better, right? But it's the true AI innovation in drug discovery, how we see it at ARC, is not only these three things, but how these things are changing and improving over the time. Faster they can change and improve, the company actually has the better data engine and then is training better AI model, right?
Yeah. And so just to like translate it into the raw economics, again, we think that starting from scratch on the current industry, it's actually a net losing proposition if you have any reasonable cost of capital to begin a drug development effort. You might as well, again, take your money elsewhere if you're doing a traditional drug development effort. If you're using AI to speed up your success rate and get to market sooner, that start from scratch itself could be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And by the time you get to phase one, which so you've gotten to where you're getting into the clinic, that asset could be worth $1 billion. Right now, it's traditional drug development. It's literally that's when you get to. Oh, maybe that's worth something more than zero, but probably worth zero. And so that's both kind of like an indication of the, call it pitiful state of the industry, and why we think that kind of AI-driven drug development could transform kind of the industry's economic structure and generates like an interesting play on trying to do that. And I do think across, there might be a handful of these companies that arise that begin to dominate the front-end drug development space because they generate capital that allows them to feed more data into their models and their models get better and better and better. There's actually, no reason why there should be 700 drug development companies. It's heavily fragmented. And that's in the public markets. There's, I'm sure, a 10x more in the private markets. This kind of innovation engine could really be like a mechanism by which the space consolidates in a really interesting way.
Exactly. And I think this can fundamentally change the business model in the healthcare and biotech.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy the conversation with Generate Bio. I hope you learn something about how biological structured data could accelerate drug development. And we'll see you next week. Hello. Welcome to FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. We've got the Generate Bio team with us today. Nemo, take it away. Why don't you introduce them and us to Generate Bio, please?
Great. Thank you, Brad. So today we are joined with Mike Anelli, who is the CEO of the Generate Bio, and Jason, who is the CFO. Generate Bio is a very exciting company in the biologics, protein, therapeutic engineering. And so maybe where we can kind of start this conversation, you know, can you kind of tell us what is the traditional kind of play when it comes to kind of biologics, antibody or protein kind of drugs discovery?
Yeah, Nemo, thanks for the time and appreciate the opportunity. Generate was founded largely because of a frustration with how traditional protein-based biotherapeutics were discovered and developed. At its core, the way we've historically discovered protein therapeutics has largely been based on borrowing from nature. So we either cull through human plasma, or we immunize a mouse, a llama. We find something that sticks to a desired biological target of interest. And then we try and manipulate it to come up with a kind of optimal drug for human use. This is a complete trial and error process. There's a randomness to it. And in many respects, what we've tried to do from a Generate perspective is use a data-driven, more engineerable approach to revolutionize the way protein-based therapeutics are discovered and developed. And what we're seeing in the early days of the technology is certainly what we can do very, very quickly is optimize existing therapeutics to extraordinary lengths, getting to the best answer for patients very, very quickly. But we're also seeing the opportunity to create entirely new tools to prosecute biology in ways that were previously inaccessible with historical techniques. And I think that's what why the future is so exciting for us, is that we can actually drug what is considered today the undruggable and solve some of the greatest unmet needs facing humanity.
Yeah, to me, it feels that kind of protein therapeutics discovery was pretty stochastic and, really kind of random. But I do also connect that with kind of, problem at task. I mean, engineering and designing proteins as drugs, it's hard issue, right? Totally. They are much more... when you compare the proteins and DNA, for example, they are much more complex. Yeah. They are much more, I wouldn't say unstable, but, they are constantly moving, and especially if they're, if they're doing their function. So how do you actually deal with this kind of problem? And what's kind of unique in the Generate approach that you think that is actually kind of helping to kind of deal with this particular obstacle?
Well, it's interesting because, one of the questions we asked ourselves at the start of the company was, if you were to apply machine learning to biology, where would you start? And proteins actually became a pretty obvious choice, just given two foundational data sets that were in the public domain. One was the sequencing revolution has sequenced now every species on the planet and given us 180 million amino acid sequences. But there was this structural biology data set called the Protein Data Bank that gave us about 200,000 high quality, high resolution structures of proteins. And while 200,000 data points doesn't seem like a lot, these are actually three-dimensional data points. So each structure contains tens of thousands of data points around the 3D dynamics of a protein. And so for us, this allowed us to start to understand interrelationships between protein sequence and protein structure. But if you're in the business of therapeutics, what's actually really interesting is actually, can you add function to that equation? Because ultimately what you care about is, can you drive the desired biological effect in a human system? And so when we started Generate in 2018, the intent was actually to have a fully integrated dry and wet lab, recognizing there was a paucity of data around functional data in a well-curated manner. And so we integrate cutting-edge computation from a machine learning perspective with a wet lab that is completely focused on automating miniaturizing, adding scale, reducing cycle time to our experimental workflows, where, you know, when we started the company, the most variants you could create to an individual target was about 100. Now we're doing, you know, sets in the millions. And that sort of data allows us to start to add that third leg to the stool, so we can find this interrelationship between DNA sequence, essentially, structure, but ultimately the biological function you're trying to drive for the therapeutic effect.
How does that then translate into, and maybe this is for Jason, but Mike, you can jump in. Okay. I have this great, call it information engine. How does it translate into the practical, like, I'm starting from scratch, I need to get to a drug, which, you know, in the traditional framework is 13 years away before I commercialize and $2.3 billion away. Like, how do you chip away at those two numbers with kind of like this information engine?
Jason, you want to start?
Yeah, I'll take it. And I did want to add one thing, Mike, to what you said, Nemo, and then Brett, I'll come back to that. In addition, the other benefit of the proteins, Nemo, is there's a paucity of data of structure interaction data where you're actually putting a protein, let's say an antibody antigen together. And with the size of those, you can actually get great imaging with cryo-EM. And so I'm sure we'll talk about this in more detail, but from a cryo-EM perspective, we have four cryo-electron microscopes, which we're now operating at scale in very high throughput with solving multiple structures on a daily basis, adding to the data bank that exists in significant ways. So basically, we think we'll have more than what's in the public domain on a proprietary basis in the next, you know, 1 to 2 years at worst. Coming back to the question around timing and dollars, it's a very interesting question. You know, we can solve part of the timing question, and we've shown that as an example. When you look at some of our lead programs, those from concept to going into the clinic are somewhere between 18 and 24 months. So we have two molecules that were actually clinical molecules. We have a third one that's about to be the third clinical molecule. All three of those are in that 18 to 24 month window from literally concept when the computer model is suggesting a sequence to getting it into human testing, so first patients. And so that time frame, which historically or even using traditional techniques is in the 3 to 5+ year range, if we can get that under 2 years, and frankly, in some cases, almost in 18 months or under that period, that really shortens the time frame. Where you have more challenges today in shortening time frames would be just some of the preclinical testing, IND enabling work, the tox studies, the scale-up in manufacturing, and then obviously running the clinical trials. I mean, what's interesting, if we'll talk more about our TSLP and sort of the way we designed that trial, we are shortening the ability for us to get to approval on that drug faster than what others may have expected. From a cost perspective, that also has meaningful implications, at least on the earlier part. So for us to get something to call it DC nomination, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions or tens of millions of dollars, which you may see more at traditional biopharma companies. Of course, the cost of scale up in manufacturing, the cost of running clinical trials, we can't solve that today. Longer term, hopefully we'll have just better predictability in our models and we can show regulatory agencies that we don't need to test as many things preclinically or as many humans in clinic. But that, I think, is a little bit off from where we are today.
Yeah, but conceptually, if you have something that plugs into a socket better, you should be able, if you have confidence in that, you can design a clinical trial that's like effectively more aggressive because you think you're going to show efficacy on a smaller number of patients, right? I mean, like, yeah. there's a degree, there's like kind of triple compounding in drug development. You like shorten time to market, which gives you more patent life once you get into commercialization. So like a better revenue curve, that shortening is like comes alongside like, you know, less dollars spent, you know, at least at equilibrium. And if you have a more efficacious drug, then you can also shorten the clinical side.
Yeah. Brett, I think you're dissecting it really nicely. And I think, you know, the TSLP example is actually a really great example of this, right? So Jason mentioned it was about, you know, TSLP was actually our first program that we initiated. It was about 2 years from concept to clinic. We were able then to design a very clever clinical trial design where we should be entering registrational trials, phase three trials this year in October. And, you know, based on, you know, the duration of those trials and based on some other, nuances that we're doing to enrich populations, that should allow us to have from concept to approval down to about, you know, 8-9 years. And so you're seeing a huge compounding effect to your point. The other lever that I think is actually that's super important, when you have new tools to prosecute biology, the other thing that allows you to do is go after biologically de-risked targets in a fundamentally different way. And so, you know, the lever that I actually see as the biggest drawing point in some respects is we can shorten the timelines, we can, you know, reduce the cost. But when you have a 5 to 10% historical probability of success in drug discovery, if you can start to materially improve that by going after things that are biologically de-risked and actually then only encounter truly, you know, execution risk, then I think you have an opportunity to really see a massive change to the underlying economic and productivity model of drug discovery. And so what we're finding with our technology, and Jason alluded to this a few minutes ago, is that, you know, when we start things, we disproportionately get to clinical candidates. And those clinical candidates, depending upon where we target, can go after biologically de-risked domains with materially better answers. And so the probability of success that we think when we enter the clinic is actually much higher than your standard protein. And so
can I understand that like a little bit? So there's an existing large molecule drug that like plugs into a socket somewhere.
Totally.
So you and it addresses the condition, but maybe sorta. And so the idea is you're going using your technology, you're able to find a better socket to plug into, or you're going after the same socket and it's like a molecule that like plugs in much more cleanly, or combination of both, or it just like does the same thing and it also does it in a way where it's not IP infringing and so you can go after it safely.
A little bit of both on that one, right? So I think if you think about the history of drug, the drug industry, you know, let's take the statin class of drugs for cholesterol, right? You know, you had the first statin, Mevacor, which was a monumental advance. But Lipitor, which was the, you know, third, fourth generation statin, was the disproportionate winner from a market perspective, because obviously it gave patients great efficacy and better convenience than the first generation answer. What this technology at a minimum, and what we're seeing very clearly today, allows you to do is it allows you to get to the best answer at the outset. So you're optimizing across all of the protein universe in one shot. And that allows you to basically give patients the best experience, the best answer. And if you look at the biggest drugs that, you know, have historically been around the industry, Humira was the third or fourth anti-TNF, but it ultimately was the biggest, you know, drug for rheumatoid arthritis in the world and the largest selling drug in the industry until recently. So for us, you know, clearly there's an opportunity to get to this best answer really, really quickly. The second thing, though, and I think this goes to your question, it's going to allow us to access biology in domains of biology that have been undruggable. Things that we know, if we had the right tool to plug into that socket, we could actually drive, you know, better outcomes for patients. But we just never had that tool in our tool belt. And so with these sort of technologies, we're seeing opportunities to do things like, can we de-immunize a bacterial enzyme? There are bacterial enzymes that we use for treatments for conditions like gout. And you know, if you could find a way to completely de-immunize it and actually bind, you know, create it in a human protein scaffold, you'd get to a much better answer than anything we've ever had before. Those tools have never been accessible to, you know, the drug discovery community. And these sort of approaches, these generative approaches, are now providing us with really good footholds to address those sort of challenges.
Maybe if you could kind of double click actually on the tool side and, you know, talk a little more about your really kind of structure first approach and, you know, kind of, you know, we all know about AlphaFold and kind of, you know, but like that's just a piece of the puzzle. And, you know, again, going back to the kind of idea that proteins are very complex, that they are constantly in motion, right? Not only when they are doing activity, you know, structure first approach is very important. So maybe if you could just kind of tell us how you actually implement that in the your lab, in the loop, kind of, or the self-driving lab kind of concept.
we made a major investment in this, in these cryo-EM microscopes, as Jason alluded to a few minutes ago. What cryo-EM microscopes allow you to do is see proteins at an atomistic level. And while there are a lot of structures in these sort of, you know, public data repositories, you know, the protein data bank, unfortunately, there's a very few protein-protein interaction data points. There's about 2,000 of those in the public domain. And again, you know, if you're making therapeutics, the freestanding protein structure is of interest, but what you really care about is how these proteins interact with biology to drive therapeutic effect. And so what we've been doing is creating cryo-EM to be a high-throughput instrument. Historically, it took about 2 to 3 months to probably solve an individual structure for a protein on one of these microscopes. Through a series of different techniques, machine learning approaches, sample preparation approaches, we have been debottlenecking that approach to make it a high-throughput instrument. And in making it a high-throughput instrument, we're solving a amount of structural data that is kind of completely was almost seen as unnecessary historically, because what you had done is you'd solve these for an individual drug candidate. We're solving them for a fundamentally different purpose. We're solving them to actually understand how proteins like to interact in a generalizable way. And, you know, we've never had the tools in biology to actually see how these proteins are interacting at a very local level. And in doing so, we think we'll be able to create fundamentally better and more powerful models to predict these generalizable principles of interaction. AlphaFold, as you rightly point out, Nemo, is a prediction engine, right? If I show you a sequence, I can predict the folding pattern of a protein. A monumental advance in biology, but the purpose of Generate is actually fundamentally different. The purpose of Generate was always not to basically predict, but to generate and create. So can we create proteins that nature has not sampled that solve a relevant therapeutic or biological task? And that's just a step further on this continuum. And the rate limiter for our ability to do that has been data. And it's these sort of data sets that we're starting to generate through cryo-EM, through functional data sets, that allow us to, you know, to have a higher degree of confidence in the sequences that are actually suggested by our models, that they will translate immediately into therapeutics for benefit for humanity.
So making the kind of cryo-EM, you know, kind of high throughput is basically kind of enabling function for you guys to make the even better model, right? That's kind of, you know, it's going to be faster, less money, and then also making the better drugs, right?
There's no doubt about it. There's a global purpose to it, as you just rightly pointed out, but there's also a very local purpose to it. And we've seen this a number of times already, right? So when we're working on a therapeutic program, we actually put structure in the loop of that. So we actually start solving structures in our iterative cycles to actually start to understand what interfaces actually drive function in the optimal way. And so there's a kind of a local learning that you will do on a program basis while we have this bigger macro perspective of how these data points will ultimately generalize to create better foundation models to create these generalizable proteins.
And Nemo, it serves, you know, multiple purposes. You know, what's really interesting is, you know, as we're getting these structure-structure interaction data, we've noticed that if we had started with AlphaFold predictions, often AlphaFold, while great, is not necessarily perfect at predicting where epitopes might be or where the actual landing spot of an antibody might be perfectly. And therefore, if we're designing against the wrong target structure, we can't get therapeutically relevant results. Whereas when we use our models to then verify and justify or validate where we're targeting, the results come out much cleaner and you know, with much fewer cycle times to get to an ultimate therapeutic. So that's one huge benefit. The other point Mike made earlier with regard to just the number of amount of data that come out of structural information and structural interaction information. I mean, again, you're talking about XYZ coordinates. So what we're able to do is with all of the wet lab assays that we do to drive optimization or assay for function or immunogenicity or all the other different assays, manufacturability, we can then take those data, combine them with the data we're getting from the actual scopes to look at the dynamicism of the kind of interaction to better define how we're going to do the next cycle to get better answers the next time. And what it's doing is it's getting us to better answers, period, but it's also getting us to those answers faster.
When we think about AI drug discovery, like often what we see in this, you know, people are talking, oh, it's faster, it's cheaper, it's better. Sure. But I don't think actually that's the right metric for the AI drug discovery company. The right metric is the how much faster, better is becoming actually, how these iteration cycles are getting shorter, because that's telling me that you're having the right data and that you're building the right model, right? Do you agree on
that's right.
Because I feel that there's often we are focused on this kind of already 2000, 2015 kind of metrics, which are actually not the true generative AI metrics that we should be thinking.
Well, I completely agree with you, Nima. I think the ultimate metric that's really important is how quickly do you get to the best answer? And can we cut down these iterative loops? And we obsess about shortening cycle times. We're constantly introducing new technologies to do so. We're constantly introducing new technologies to generate higher quality data at scale, all with a goal of having better models that ultimately have faster results to getting to the optimal answer. The long-term vision of Generate is for every unique patient's individual condition, could we actually create a model that would give us the optimal therapeutic instantaneously?
True precision medicine. That's a true precision medicine.
Right? And that's a long way off. Like, you know, I don't think we're going to unravel the complexities of biology in the next 3 years or 5 years. But I think, you know, you can, we know, what we do know is that when we are born, what is passed between parents and child is a code. That code is DNA. That code codes for all biological function. So there is an interrelationship that is to be learned. The question is how much data will it require to actually learn and master that interrelationship? And I think we're on that's why I think over the course of the next couple of decades, this is the biologic century. We are going to start to unravel that code in massive and meaningful ways that will ultimately allow us not only to create better human therapeutics, but to solve challenges in agriculture, sustainability, material science, that these sort of technologies ultimately potentially open up.
Imagine you're trying to accelerate towards that future, and there's always like a choke point that then you're trying to efficiently throw allocation towards of resources to like unchoke it, right?
Right.
What are the pinch points today and anticipated pinch points? Or maybe put it another way, with a marginal dollar, are you buying another cryo EM machine? Are you investing in some other kind of physical testing infrastructure? Are you buying a GPU? Or are you, paying for an additional clinical trial? Maybe that's a slightly different category, but how do you think about kind of like that capital allocation puzzle to making sure you're accelerating efficiently?
Yeah, it's constantly evolving, Brett. I mean, like at its core, right? Like, and there's a couple of fronts that we actually are pushing really, really hard on. And I think you've seen this, you know, across a number of different AI-based categories, right? The underlying machine learning methods, we have to keep pushing the frontiers on, right? And as we've seen, like, if you think about generative image generation, right? Over a five-year period, we've seen from kind of grainy images with people with six fingers to exquisite pictures. And a lot of some of it's data, but a lot of it's method development, right? And we're on a similar trajectory within these machine learning models of biology to continue to push those frontiers. The nice thing about that is that's actually relatively cheap in terms of you need some world-class machine learning scientists, but once you have them, it's actually about letting them continue to push the frontiers, allow them to draw inspiration from all these other domains where we're seeing advances to make these models more powerful in biology. On the cryo-EM side, right now, we are working kind of maniacally. We don't have a hardware problem per se today. We have enough machines. How do we make those machines more productive? How do we automate and make those machines work 24/7 and actually solve plates of structures, not individual structures at one point in time? And that to us is the biggest question. As we do that and we get to a point where those things are really, really humming, you know, full time, then you start asking questions, do we need to add the next machine? From a wet lab experimentation perspective, a lot of what we've been solving is speed. So cycle, how do we reduce cycle times? One of the long poles in the tent has been how long it takes to grow proteins in cells. And so there are new techniques like cell-free protein synthesis that allow us to shave weeks off of those iterative cycles. So if we can grow these proteins in days versus weeks, that's a massive accelerant to everything we do. Now, each of those steps, we're constantly, you know, as we solve one thing, as we bring in protein, you know, cell-free, there's a new long pull. And so we're innovating on each of these, just constantly being relentless about how we continue to rev this data generation engine to do so in a way that allows us to learn faster and faster.
At some point, don't you run into, like, you get really fast at that, and then you have a ton of assets that you could bring into preclinic,
right?
Which is a much harder, like, suddenly that's a very expensive decision. So then do you, like, or you need a lot more capital, which, yeah, you know, maybe if you're demonstrating, like, this is working marvelously, then that's not a problem. And as somebody that's in the public markets, it's like, even once you get into the clinic, there's a long way to go until people believe that what you're doing is going to yield, like, real value on the back end, right? And so kind of how do you just select for, oh, I'm doing the very best assets here, and I am confident that this kind of, like, data generation platform that I'm building is both leading me there and going to allow me to be very powerful and proliferating a lot. Do you need a lot of partners to then take on those projects to basically, like, offload the capital intensity of that? How do you think about that set of relationships and decisions in terms of business, both strategy and just, like, tactics?
All the above, Brett. In reality, I think you actually summed it up pretty well. So the challenge, as Mike has articulated and you're recognizing, given the success at which our molecules, once we start them, get toward the clinic, is the capital intensity of running a clinical trial. And, you know, whether it's scaling up manufacturing, running the first phase one clinical trial, and for TSLP, it's going to be running phase three clinical trial in multiple indications, COPD and severe asthma as examples. And so what we've done to date is leverage partnerships in multiple ways. So we have a large partnership with Amgen and Novartis. Amgen is a partnership we've had for 3 years. Novartis, we signed back in September of 2024. And those are on multi-target deals where those companies gave us dollars, meaningful dollars up front, to then work with them on a select number of targets. And we would then turn those targets over to them at either lead candidate criteria or DC nomination when they're met. And then there'd be milestones and royalties that would be paid as they bring them forward. Then there are other types of partnerships that we've leveraged to go into areas either like cell therapy, because again, as you may recall, our technology is not only therapeutic area agnostic, it's also modality agnostic. So as we're running proteins, those are not just antibodies. So we're in enzymes and growth hormones and, you know, all the other things that we've talked about in the past. But cell therapy is one example. And so instead of us, we are not cell manufacturers, but proteins are very important and relevant to cell therapy. We partnered with Roswell Park as an example in a 50-50 collaboration partnership, share 50% of the cost, share 50% of the economics. And we've done the same with MD Anderson going into things like T-cell engagers, but really after unique targets that, you know, the world isn't really focused on because they don't know about them yet. And MD Anderson has so much data on their patients and biomarkers. And so that's another way that we can go after something but mitigate the capital intensity. The third type of partnership that we'd be exploring, and so the first point is, as we bring things, we don't plan to bring everything to commercialization. We don't plan to commercialize everything ourselves at this point. What we plan to do is get things to human proof of concept, get them over the value inflection points so that we can monetize them in a meaningful way that would allow us to take additional capital in a non-equity dilutive manner to go invest continuously in that platform. Over time, you know, once we find that we've mastered all of the different technology stacks that we're focused on, you know, the first one was really in the optimization technology stack, taking kind of something existing and just making it better using our platform, which again, couldn't be done with traditional techniques, but lower biology risk. you know, now we move into more de novo, more undruggable areas that Mike has talked about where you can't use traditional techniques to get there. And so we'll be able to prosecute that with capital that we gain from some of these other types of partnerships that we're going down the path of. So it's really a mix of a lot of different ways to gain capital to be able to allocate it across these different programs.
Brett, I think the one thing I just add here is, you know, one of the inherent benefits of these sort of digital technologies and these computational approaches is scalability. And, you know, drug discovery has never been a scalable enterprise because it's been down to a genius, right? It's been an individual genius or a team of genius, and it's hard to scale genius. Like I always say, there's been one Mozart, there's been one Leonardo da Vinci. It's hard to really scale that genius to be, you know, easily replicable. And that's why, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has always struggled with scale. There's been, you know, a detriment to scale in the industry. So, you know, from our vantage point, you know, with as you put the computer at the center of that process, there are now scale dynamics being introduced into drug discovery for the first time. Our technology is not inherently limited in terms of the number of programs we start. Where we get caught is the capital intensity if we start things. And so, as Jason rightly points out, partnerships have to be a core part of our model because we couldn't afford to take everything forward on our own. And, you know, obviously there are, you know, as a small company, we're 330 people, yet we are working on about 20 different programs. And that would be the size of a pipeline of a company, maybe 30, 40 times our size in our, on the research base. And so we have to think of creative ways. We don't have all the expertise. We don't, you know, we're not masters of every therapeutic area. So can we tap into expertise in other domains? Like, I'd love to solve neuroscience. We don't.
Good luck.
Right. It's a long putt. But, you know, we don't have that expertise within our company. We don't understand the brain well enough. We can't effectively model it. And so that's not an area where we'll devote time. But there are other organizations that is their purpose. And if we can leverage our technology with them to contribute, that could be awesome.
So Nemo and I have actually had these debates. I agree with you that kind of there's a... Yeah, previously it's like scientist has great idea, then scientist goes and starts his own company because why would he jump onto somebody else's platform? It's his right. idea. And he's just as likely to like raise capital and succeed on his own. Then there is no mechanism by which somebody could get really good by being really good at kind of drug development. And the counterexamples are it's like Genentech, you know, got to recombinant DNA first. Yep. And so then attracted all the talent in that area. So they had talent on a certain tool, you know, and that worked for a while. And then, you know, various things happened, and others followed on and using recombinant DNA. And then it seems like the scale driver in the business has basically been distribution. It's like you have a salesperson that's going around to every doctor. Well, it's more efficient to give them a larger catalog. And, you know, you can specialize in an indication area because it's like, well, you're going around to all the liver patients. And so then you can specialize. But it's all been on the kind of like the ability to sell side of the business that all the scale has been driven. And so if you have a drug development engine that's driven by kind of data, it makes sense that one, that could be the mechanism by which an organization, a franchise, hopefully yours, becomes very, very large, where previously it was heavily fragmented. And then two, it makes sense, like if that's going to be the core kind of like thing you're executing on, you need to like aggressively cleave off all of the capital intensity downstream of that so that you can build up kind of that data generation engine. And it's just... does that run, you know, in some ways your partners have to believe that what you're doing really is special in order to give you kind of like the economics that you would argue you deserve given how great a protein you're giving to them. And so then that's maybe the challenge of the business development.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think if you just look at the industry order today, there's a couple of handfuls of super large that control the distribution, as you rightly point out. They have the brute force that, you know, we'll take de-risked assets and then do the large-scale trials and commercialize. To a large extent, they still control a lot of the rent in this industry. And you have a very fragmented supplier base in biotech, right? The number of biotechs is in the thousands that are all trying to innovate. I think with these sort of learning technologies, you can see for the first time advantages to scale in that discovery process. And I think that's a really important point. Now, the question, and I think from a business model perspective that we've always been wrestling with is, right now, as Jason pointed out, human proof of concept phase two kind of has been this marker where large pharma will now say, now it's biologically de-risked, and therefore I'm willing to pay a huge premium for things. Prior to that point, they're typically paying a discount, right? Because they're saying, well, now we're encountering that biological risk, and so we're not going to pay as much. I think as these technologies are proven out over time, you have an ability to start to argue that that time point should be placed earlier in a less capital intensive spot. And so I think, you know, I do think these sort of approaches, and I, you know, we hope it'll be, you know, a company like Generate will disrupt the economic order of this industry in a very material way. Because if you, you know, really think about it, and I spent 18 years at Merck, right? One of the large pharmaceutical companies. There are pieces of that offering that are highly commoditized, right? Like, it's hard for me to say how much distinctive value is in the pure distribution. They're all really good at it, and they do an exceptional job of getting, you know, important medicines to patients that need them. But how distinctive is one versus the other? If you have power on the discovery side, you can start to actually use that to your advantage over time. Right now, the problem is biotech is so fragmented, you never have that consolidated power to effectively negotiate against the established industry order.
Yeah, and I'll add one more thing, then swing to Nemo. But, you know, if you look at least our modeling, there's a reason they don't pay you for even a phase one. It's because on the traditional drug discovery, like, set of fail rates and costs, phase one is net present value zero.
Yeah, exactly.
It literally doesn't pencil at a discount rate that makes any sense at all.
That's right.
And so, but what's interesting is if you're delivering a drug to somebody with, like, time to commercialization, you still have longer patent life.
Yeah.
And it's has a better chance of throughput rate through clinical trial. You can have that phase one drug be worth, you know, $900 million going against, like, an average peak sale. Like, it literally can go from a zero value asset that they're not going to pay you anything for to almost a $1 billion asset that you should be able to say, hey, listen, we're passing this off to you. Let's, you know, figure out how to share economics, and we need capital to continue to invest in the front end of this franchise.
That's very well said. Completely agree.
Yeah, I think my question was just more, I really believe that this R&D sharing economy, you know, and Ginkgo was talking about that early, even before, but I think in drug discovery, that's going to be a new kind of business model. But, you know, the question is when that paradigm is going to kind of happen. And we have some other kind of companies in our portfolio, Recursion, even the EPSI, which are kind of, you know, trying to pioneer that. But how do you think about the timeline for this kind of shift, that there is this really R&D kind of sharing economy as the business model?
Yeah, I think it's a 5 to 10 year journey, Nemo. I wish it was faster. Large pharma is oriented to pure assets. That's how, you know, that is the currency they trade in right now. And they procure services at a discount. And, you know, I wish that would change and be, you know, faster. But the reality is that right now, and you hear it a lot, there's air of skepticism about some of these approaches, you know, within, you know, the broad, is this hype? Is this reality? Is this actually going to change the fundamentals of drug discovery and development? You know, some people will point back to the genetic revolution, and, you know, when sequencing came around and, you know, everything was going to be solved all of a sudden. And, you know, 20 years later, we're kind of, you know, clearly everyone is integrated into their process, but have we seen material improvements in productivity? Those are all, I think, fair observations. The other thing that I spend a lot of time thinking about is, you know, how well positioned is the industry to effectively evaluate these sort of technologies? You know, in most of these research organizations, you're probably talking about 5% of the workforce that's skilled at the intersection of science and technology. You have some of the best biological minds in the world, and I would never say anything but that. But this is a new breed of scientists that are starting to emerge that, you know, are, you know, in our case, experts in machine learning and protein engineering. That population is growing rapidly, but the ability to effectively evaluate what is what, given the proliferation of these companies, I think makes a lot of people very skeptical. And in a risk-averse stance, the first step is a partnership before you fully adopt. And I think that just, you know, given the lead times and how long it takes to prove some of these things out, that's why I point to like a 5-year, you know, window. Because I think over the next 5 years, we'll start to see the successes. And as we see increasing success, I think that will be the argument to fundamentally change the model.
And I think, you know, and I definitely hear your argument about, like, you know, especially in biotech healthcare, you know, we had a, you know, human genome sequence, you know, there was during the dot-com bubble, there was also a kind of computational revolution, right? And nothing really kind of really pan out, right? But I think, you know, why is it different now? This is not, oh, we have AI, but we actually have the tools that can read biology a lot, and then we have AI. So it's a convergence of the different things, right? And so I think that, you know, and just a fun fact here about me, right? I did my PhD at MIT in this kind of program, which is like bioengineering, computational biology. And I was just the eighth generation of that program. And this is MIT, right? So you don't even have the right kind of staff. You're not educating right mindsets to think about this. And, you know, a lot of classmates in biology, they go to biology because they don't like math. Oh my God, for biology, you need the math most.
That's right.
You know?
But And we're seeing a change, right? Like when I joined Generate, there were 90 people in the world skilled at the intersection of machine learning and protein engineering. And we knew all 90, right? Now you're seeing this outflow. You know, there's a supply and demand dynamic. The people we were competing against for talent weren't large pharma. We were competing against Google. We were competing against Amazon. We were competing against Salesforce. Facebook had a protein team. It was large tech that, you know, were really embracing these sort of approaches because they saw that, you know, one of the frontiers of these next waves of technology would be to actually understand biology. And, you know, now we're seeing, you know, extraordinary talent start to come through a handful of these key labs more and more every year that is starting to bring a critical mass to these sort of questions. And I think that's what's so exciting is, you know, I think, you know, oftentimes when we think about these domains and silos, you know, we've squeezed a lot of the juice out of the silo. A lot of these greatest advances are going to come at the intersections. And, you know, I think the biggest, you know, key to success for anyone in this kind of tech bio space is mastering the horizontal operating model from computation to experimentation to clinic, adding in the engineering layer on top to industrialize it. Those are tribes that don't naturally cohabitate. And, you know, for us, being able to create an environment where these groups work seamlessly together on an end-to-end problem is something that certainly I think on a daily basis is where we spend a lot of our time figuring out how do we do this? How do we do it better? How do we bring a common operating system across these different tribes to drive to the best business outcomes?
As a close observer of, I mean, all the technologies we focus on, but really, you know, I think we have the only, at least published forecast for cost declines in core AI that I've seen that exists, where we think performance per cost is roughly doubling every 4 to 5 months. We think that's prospectively going to happen through the end of the decade. And it's clear you can palpably feel it. The tooling is changing under people's feet in language model space all the time. And that has implications for kind of your space, for autonomous systems, for every technology we focus on. How, like, to what degree are you having to kind of like rebuild the engine as you're trying to fly and come to conclusions on the plane? Do you know what I mean? Like, how much is the kind of architectural advance within kind of the language model space, like flowing through into the biology space? And how does your team even evaluate or keep up with it?
We're a company that was founded in 2018, you know, the fall of 2018. We recognize that if we don't actually fundamentally challenge the premises on which the organization was built, we will be obsolete in the not too distant future. Right. So language models were in their nascency when Generate was founded. They change how we think about science at a foundational level. Right. And, you know, we talked a little bit about the lab in the loop type concepts. But there's no reason we're not driving agentic workflows to create an experimental loop that's fully automated and at a pace and a scale that was unimaginable. There's no reason that these large language models aren't going to be foundational in hypothesis generation. And so then running those, you know, then testing those hypotheses in an automated setting. And then this then extends to how we run every part of our business, right? Like, and there are pieces of this that we try and prioritize just because we can't do everything. But like we were talking about clinical development being the cost bottleneck for this. I mean, there are some things here, right? Where if you think about like from the time a study finishes to study report closeout, right now is about a 3-month process. Why not plug a large language model on the back end and make that a 3-day process where you have the all of the reports written, and then you use your talented scientists to review those reports and make the necessary modifications, right? Again, to your point, that then is adding 3 months of patent life. But we have to kind of fundamentally challenge all parts of our business on a daily basis, given this wave of technology. And we've just been really fortunate. You know, the advantage you have as a relatively early company here, digitally native company here, is you have people who are more tech savvy in your workforce. At the same time, what we're really starting to challenge though is how scientists actually do their work. And you know, all human beings have a degree of resistance to that level of change.
How do you measure, like it seems like, imagine I buy the pitch, I buy that this all is all working. What is like your pulse on whether or not your kind of innovation engine is like the KPI? Maybe even not the top level, but even like at the cryo EM level, is it like do you have ambitions for like number, basically like data generation off those machines over time? Right.
And then number of structure solved, success rate of structures, cycle times of runs, all of those things are carefully scrutinized. And right, so we know, based on the plans, right? And then we sit there and add new technologies and we say, are we starting to see the advances at the pace and the rate that we had hoped? If not, what's wrong, right? And that's where you start to troubleshoot. You can dissect this and down to pretty fine details in each and every one of these segments. But again, you talked about like at its core, I think the red herring in all of this is speed purely and cost purely. These are not pure efficiency plays, right? What the generative AI revolution is actually providing is actually an effectiveness and a quality play that is fundamentally different. Generative AI is aiding the creative process for the first time in ways computational techniques have historically aided the efficiency agenda. And for us, we're getting to those better answers faster. And that's the ultimate thing that I look at is like, are we doing things and are we getting to more distinctive answers in a faster and cheaper way?
Well, yeah, I think the two are kind of intrinsically tied, and it reminds me of the in the language space, like one of the things like test time compute is the idea that hey, you can basically run the experiment internally over and over and get to a better answer.
That's right.
But here you're just transporting that into like physical biological space, and it's like being able to do a bunch of cycles and iterations gets you to a better molecule ultimately, or a better large molecule. Yeah.
It gets you to that, but it also, which is a little different than the speed point, is it may get you to things that traditional techniques just cannot solve for. And that's kind of the direction this company is in part going, right? I mean, we'll continue to prosecute across a broad range of opportunities, but we've talked about enzyme grafting in the past as an example, which is taking a bacterial enzyme catalytic site that may be very immunogenic in humans if you're looking for enzyme replacement therapy, but actually grafting it onto a human protein framework. So it's a very small piece that is put into a large protein framework that doesn't become immunogenic. You can't do that with traditional techniques, right? You need a computer to do that. And ARC models can basically suggest here's a million different locations and ways that you could put these two things together. We'll run that out in minutes, seconds, and then we can go and build all those and test all those to see if they actually have functionality that would work and be helpful to patient populations. That is, you know, partly about speed and all the other pieces we've talked about, but it's almost entirely about finding solutions for patients that just do not exist and can't be found under what we have today.
Yeah, I think for me, I go back to this that we, we talked in the beginning, but you know, it's actually better, faster, where there is a rate of change that is improving, right? I think that's totally the ultimate KPI, right, that we want to be tracking. And this is why really the proprietary data, you know, and the tools to have to make that enables you actually model, which is over the time better and better and better. And, you know, I that's the, for me, the true value creation, you know, which none of the big pharma and kind of traditionalists can't even think about, right?
The other one I would say, Nima, so I agree with that entirely. The other piece that I think that's really exciting is, as these new tools reveal themselves, there is an enormous first mover advantage if you can figure out the most valuable applications of them.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Speed to market is exceptionally important here. And if you're at the forefront of developing novel tools, and then you can find the most valuable applications and cherry pick those that you pursue on your own, that's, I think, where you're going to create extraordinary value. And to us, certainly we agree with your thesis around kind of, it's not just the pure speed and time, but it's the derivative. I also think being first with these tools allows us to answer these questions in ways like, you know, the TSLP example was based on an observation that we could change the binding region of proteins in a fundamentally more profound way than historical techniques could, and therefore search the space more effectively and get to a better answer. That then allows us to say, all right, we're going to go after the most valuable applications of that, and we are the ones that can patent those first.
Yeah, but to me, this comes to like a chicken and egg question, right? But because I love platforms, and you know, that could be because I did my first internship in Flagship, so I got addicted to platforms, you know. But like, you know, you coming with that asset example, it creates value, gives you the money, which you put in the platform, which then there is the derivative change, and that's that, you know, that's the flying wheel for me.
Well, that's right. I mean, the thing that we obsess about, and Jason and I spend a lot of time thinking about, is certainly how do we advance technology and how do we, you know, capture, you know, address the biggest unmet needs. But what kills biotech companies is oftentimes a capital dependency cycle, right? The ebbs and flows of science do not necessarily align with a long lead time capital dependency cycle. So if you can figure out how you balance that platform development while monetizing to reduce your reliance on investor capital. And, you know, we think with like our anti-TSLP antibody, as it goes into phase three trials, now you're talking about billions of dollars of potential value for a single asset. That allows you to kind of, you know, change this dynamic and actually really prosecute the platform thesis in a foundationally different way.
Yeah. I mean, as someone, you know, I've talked to a lot of certainly public equities analysts over the last couple of years on the therapeutic space itself. And if you ask them, how do you value a platform? They say, if you're valuing a platform, you're in trouble. Like you should know on two assets what the company is worth.
Right.
And on an ROIC basis, like on the basis of what matters over the long term, the platform should be effectively all of the value.
That's
you know, I mean, you get the cash flow off of the drug, but like the other problem people have had with kind of, you know, drug developers generally, it's like, if your return on R&D is 4%, I'd rather just like clip coupons off of a treasury bond, right? And so that's the whole magic here, or the whole, you know, what we think is going to happen. I mean, the reason, you know, we're with you all and we is because like this could change the returns for the industry and cause returns to accrue in kind of a different dynamic than they have before.
Completely agree with that, Brett. I struggled with this at Merck for 20 years, right? Like two curves that I couldn't ever reconcile. R&D productivity going down for four decades in a row And the price of medicines leading to inadequate patient access of medicines. That leads to a reputational issue with the industry that puts it on par with tobacco. If you think about these sort of technologies, we believe that they will break the productivity cycle. And by breaking the productivity cycle, it allows you to change the business model.
Well, we look forward to that future and kind of the incremental steps along the way that hopefully will kind of demonstrate that the platform can get these great assets to market so that you can, you know, keep the flywheel spinning and cause it to accelerate. Thank you so much, Jason and Mike, for joining us and enjoy the conversation.
Appreciate the time today, guys.
Thank you for joining FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. Please like, subscribe on the podcasting platform of your choice and follow us at Ark Invest on X or myself at Winton Ark on X. We hope you enjoyed the conversation about AI's acceleration of drug development. I do think this business cycle will prove to be a momentous one in biology. And, you know, Generate gave you an example of how things are accelerating. Well, we're going to begin to see the financial evidence of what that means for these platforms and companies. So we'll keep a close eye on it. And I'm sure we'll have them and other AI drug discoveries onto the podcast in the future as they hopefully yield good results from their kind of R&D engines and clinical trials. So thank you for joining us and see you next week.
ARK believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARK. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.